Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Facebook. That's the problem. And we're talking about symptoms, but the problem is the unprecedented economic control of every form of social discourse and communication.
Facebook is getting grilled this week, and this time it's outside the U.S. On Tuesday, regulators from 9 countries, including Canada, Singapore, France, and Brazil, met in the United Kingdom for a joint inquiry into the social media giant. But there was one person who didn't show up.
Okay, so we don't have Mr. Zuckerberg here today.
Mr. Zuckerberg is not here. So Mr. Zuckerberg's decision not to appear here at Westminster, to me, speaks volumes.
A failure to account for the loss of trust.
Trust. That's a word that was on the mind of a number of regulators at the hearing.
Can you not see that this has caused a massive breach of trust, not just between parliaments with the company, but with many people who watch these deliberations as well?
British and European regulators are also investigating Facebook for its role in the 2016 Brexit vote and U.S. elections. They say Facebook failed to address misinformation campaigns and foreign interference on the platform. At Tuesday's meeting, Richard Allen, a vice president of policy solutions at Facebook, stressed the social media platform's importance. Allen spoke on the company's behalf next to a chair left empty for Zuckerberg.
Unless you're going to turn off the internet, I am not confident that people, the people we serve, you serve, would be better off in a world where Facebook is not able, however imperfectly, to offer services where we spend 15 years learning how to do it.
Turning off the internet, not a real solution. So what are the answers? Has Facebook become a company that's just too big to fail? This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Tony Rahm is a tech policy reporter for The Washington Post. Tony, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And I've also got Tim Wu with me here in the studio in New York. He's a law professor at Columbia University and author of the new book, The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Age. Tim, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
All right, a lot to unpack here, the biggest social network that we all probably have had something to do with at some point. Tony, why was Mark Zuckerberg a no-show at this huge meeting? And what did you think about Richard Allen's handling of the situation?
Yeah, Facebook was certainly in the hot seat. Now, if you listen to the words of Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg and his staff, the reason he was not in the United Kingdom for this unprecedented hearing of 9 countries is because he was, quote, unable to attend. That was the same line that Facebook had fed regulators for months as they demanded that Zuckerberg show up. The reality is that Facebook doesn't want to have to subject its chief executive to hearing after hearing around the world as frustrations continue to bubble up about what Facebook does with private information it collects about users or how it combats ills like misinformation that spreads on its platform. But as you pointed out in that clip just to start this segment, there were a lot of frustrated regulators who firmly believe that the only person who can really answer for what's happening with Facebook is the guy at the top. And there's nothing that suggests that these regulators are going to give up and stop demanding more from Zuckerberg just because they had one hearing yesterday.
And Tony, you mentioned privacy and user privacy in particular. We sort of touched on a couple of the issues at the top, but could you give us like the 3 bullet points that really these world governments are most concerned about when it comes to Facebook? Is it user privacy?
I think it was best summed up actually by Charlie Angus, who is a member of parliament from Canada who attended the hearing yesterday. He said, quote, "While we were playing on our phones and our apps, our democratic institutions, our form of civil conversation seems to have been upended by frat boy billionaires from California." And so it's everything. It's the way that Facebook collects information and how it monetizes that. It's the misinformation or the disinformation spread by foreign agents or other bad actors on the platform and what Facebook is doing to combat that. And then it's even more alarming content like hate speech and what Facebook is doing to take that stuff down as fast as its users or its regulators would like. It's a number of issues, and I think regulators aren't going to let up on Facebook anytime soon, even after yesterday's hearing.
Tim, I want to bring you in here because at the top of the show, I mean, the real central question here is we hear this a lot when it came to the economic crisis. You know, these big banks are too big to fail. First of all, what does it mean to be too big to fail?
Well, I don't really believe in that concept personally. I think in the bank context, it means that the industry's failure would create an economic catastrophe, systemic problems. But I really don't feel that's true of the big tech companies, particularly not Facebook. So I'm one of those who's in favor of the breakup of Facebook. I guess I'll get right to it. I don't think it would be a problem to break it into at least Instagram and WhatsApp. And so, yes, I don't think that's an appropriate thing to talk about when it comes to big tech.
But why is it so hard for governments? I mean, we're seeing this happen not just with our own U.S. government, but we saw just a couple days ago, governments around the world can't seem to wrangle Facebook, at least not its CEO, at least not in a timely manner. So why haven't we been able to figure this out yet?
I mean, I think Facebook is an interesting case in testing essentially the power of democracy in our times. You know, are these companies actually accountable? And Facebook has very carefully played the line of pretending to be accountable. You know, in the United States, at least, it shows up. It goes on lengthy apology tours. It agrees to meaningless consent decrees. It's willing to do anything short of actually changing. And it's an interesting way that companies you know, today try to gain immunity from government, which is not completely, I mean, he didn't show up, but he sent somebody. Not completely ignoring government, but kind of just doing enough to try to appease them.
Sort of flying slightly above it, if you will. Tony, you mentioned the Angus comments. I want to talk a little bit about, at one point during the inquiry, he mentioned, floated a Facebook idea that went beyond just regulation. Let's take a listen.
Perhaps the best regulation would be antitrust. Because people who don't like Facebook, well, they could go to WhatsApp. But, oh, we have problems in South America. We have problems in Africa. And we have to go back to Mr. Zuckerberg, who's not here. My daughters who get off Facebook, well, they go to Instagram. But that's now controlled by Facebook. That perhaps the simplest form of regulation would be to break Facebook up or treat it as a utility.
Tony, we often have this this discussion about whether tech companies, for example, like Google, are considered, you know, utilities at this point. We just heard Tim say that he thinks Facebook should be broken up. Tony, what's Facebook's response been to suggestions that it should be broken up or maybe that it itself is too big?
Yeah, Facebook most certainly opposes that line of argumentation, right? By their logic, there are plenty of competitors in the market space, and they point to everything from YouTube as an example of a social network that they compete against to a number of apps like iMessage, for instance, on your iPhone as a competitor to WhatsApp. Now, as Tim would probably point out here, that's not nearly enough. Facebook gains many advantages by having as many apps as it does, and part of that advantage comes from the amount of data they're able to collect on users and what insights they're able to derive from that. But just to go back to something that Tim said, there's a difference between oversight and the performance of oversight. And that's often what we see play out at some of these hearings. We've heard both in the U.S. and abroad regulators who want to break up Facebook or want to bring down the full force of antitrust law against the company to deal with its inability to handle a number of things, privacy or otherwise. But often that doesn't really translate to the sort of investigations that I think a lot of advocates would like to see. And really, at the end of the day, it's going to come down to whether the people who pull the levers of power are actually willing to go after the company, to fine it, to take the sorts of actions that might change its business practices.
Yeah, and I'd like to get in there. You know, I worked in government and law enforcement, and I think you're making a very good point. Facebook believes that the political actors just want to have a say, you know, yell at Mark Zuckerberg or yell at their representatives and put on a show. But and they're happy to give them that show and they're basically waiting for things to blow over. They've had definitely a blow over style approach, or agree to low key consent decree approaches. That's why, and you know that's been sort of the story for the last 5 years. Facebook is a recidivist. You know, they've been in trouble multiple times, and that's why I think it's important that as was said, that enforce the people who pull the triggers on antitrust enforcement really. Bring threats that are beyond fines and, you know, do this, but a threat of a serious breakup.
And I'm also, I'm sorry, go ahead, yeah. Tony.
I was going to say, we actually have an instance of that coming up, right? So Facebook is under investigation here in the United States for its entanglement with Cambridge Analytica. That's that political consultancy that improperly accessed personal data on about 87 million Facebook users. That's a violation of a settlement that the FTC had brokered with Facebook a few years ago, and now the agency can bring fines against Facebook.
Tony, that's you mentioned the FTC. FTC had its own hearing about Facebook yesterday. So what happened in that?
Yeah, they were asked a lot of questions about what are they going to do? When is this investigation going to wrap up? There are a lot of lawmakers, particularly Democrats, who would like to see the agency issue sky-high fines and force Facebook to change its business practices with some other remedies. Now, the FTC didn't say anything. Its chairman, Joe Simon, said he couldn't comment on an active investigation, but there's certainly a lot of pressure for the FTC to use this investigation to say something, not just to Facebook, but to the rest of the rest of Silicon Valley and some of these large tech companies that they're not playing around.
Just stand by for 1 second, because I know Tim wants to get in here, but I want to ask you both. Tim, you mentioned accountability. Tony, you've talked about oversight. Tim, you said that Facebook sort of takes a blowover approach. Is any of that because, and we all know how Washington works, is this lobbying? Is this funding? Is this what is driving this sort of, you know, blowover approach, as you said?
I mean, I think Facebook early on realized they needed to have a very sophisticated DC operation. Sheryl Sandberg is an expert in how Washington operates, and they learned early on the real game is appeasement and giving people their theater and then waiting for things to blow over. That's a game a lot of companies play, and some of the exposés have shown that. The one thing I want to bring up about the FTC is I'm worried, having worked there, that the FTC is going to think like $100 million is a lot of money. You know, inside the
for
agency.
For a company like Facebook, yeah.
Or just period. Mm. You know, they've never asked for billions of dollars of fines. They're like, oh, we're going to ask for $1 million. That'll scare them. They're not, I'm not sure if they're used to thinking the number and the scale that Facebook operates at.
And is there political will? I mean, what can be done, Tim, to really break this up?
Well, you have an antitrust investigation and a lawsuit. I think Justice Department, FTC could both do it. Europe could do it. I think their mergers in 2010s were illegal, that they illegally bought Instagram and WhatsApp, and I don't think it would be that hard to bring an action to break those companies off.
Tony, your assessment of that?
It's going to come down to political will, honestly, both from the folks who investigate these companies at the Department of Justice, at the Federal Trade Commission, and in some sense from members of Congress who can use their powers, who can use the bully pulpit to kind of nudge these agencies, to give them the political cover they need to do this sort of thing. But Facebook is sophisticated. It's been able to battle back this sort of thing in the past. It would be a different conversation, however, if Democrats had been in charge of the agency. I think there might have been a little bit more appetite, as evidenced by the Democratic commissioners, who talk about this sort of thing.
To a certain extent, Tony. I mean, I covered this industry under Democrats, and there was also some issues there. We're coming up on the end of the segment here. I want to ask you both, because we hear a lot about this from users of Facebook. People say, I'm getting off the platform. I don't trust it anymore. With 15 seconds to go, Tim, what do you think? Does it matter if I stop using Facebook to Facebook?
It does, but it would be better if you had something to switch to that wasn't owned by Facebook.
There you go. Tony, what about you? Does it matter to Facebook if I or you or any of us stop using?
Yeah, you know what? Most people are not using Facebook, or not most people. Some people aren't using Facebook, but they're still using Instagram, right? Which gets back to the question of its bigness.
That's a lot of people. Tony Rahm, tech policy reporter for The Washington Post. Tony, thank you.
Thanks.
And Tim Wu, professor of law at Columbia University and author of The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Age. Tim, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
I'm Eve Smith from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I trust it as much as I trust any platform. I figure the scandals mean they're fixing things and working on it. It's less scrutinized corners of the internet where my information is most vulnerable.
I have a love-hate relationship with Facebook. I've been bullied, slandered, harassed, threatened on Facebook, and had to take down after repeated efforts to reach anyone at Facebook. For already economically disadvantaged people like myself, Facebook is a way to communicate. But at what cost is unknown.
Hi, this is Andy from Philadelphia. I don't trust Facebook at all. I've deleted all the information about myself, except for a birth date that makes me 40 years younger than I am, maybe not even old enough to be on Facebook. And I never post anything. If it weren't for two private groups I'm in, I would drop out completely.
Hey, this is Andrew from O'Fallon, Missouri. And honestly, I've shut down my Facebook page, and I don't plan on going back.
My name is Mary. I live in suburban Philadelphia. No, I do not trust Facebook. Actually, I trust it as far as I can throw it. I used it very briefly at the outset. Then I realized the crowd mentality. As the number of people increases, the likelihood of despicable behavior increases.
The user experience has completely degraded and lost its original purpose. Instead of being a way to connect with friends, stay in touch, and share what's going on in our lives, Facebook has tried to become the be-all and end-all of everything.
This is Nadine from Los Altos, California. No, I don't trust Facebook anymore. Over time, it became obvious that Mark Zuckerberg was not going to take any responsibility for how the platform was negatively affecting our democracy. I now just use it only intermittently and just posting a few pictures here and there for my family.
You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. In 2008, a 23-year-old Mark Zuckerberg was looking for a partner to make Facebook profitable, so he hired Sheryl Sandberg. Since then, Facebook's reach has grown to more than 2.2 billion monthly users. It's worth more than $500 billion. But with all the scandals this year for Facebook, Sandberg's leadership has been under scrutiny. And some have even extended that scrutiny to her branded feminism platform, Lean In, based on her 2013 book. Sandberg has been front and center in the response to allegations of foreign interference and disinformation campaigns on the platform. Here she is testifying before Congress back in September.
We have been investing very heavily in people, in our systems, in decreasing the dissemination of fake news, in transparency.
Issy Lepowski is a senior writer for Wired, and I asked her how much responsibility does Sandberg bear in Facebook scandals?
She bears tons of responsibility. She's the number two at arguably the most powerful company in the world, and this company has had a lot of problems recently, a lot of them resting on her shoulders. Sheryl heads up PR and communications for Facebook. They all report to her. She's responsible for building Facebook's advertising business, which has obviously been beleaguered and riddled with issues, including Russian trolls buying ads and other types of misinformation spreading through ads. She's been tasked with managing Facebook's relationship with Washington, which isn't going all that well. So I think that there's a lot that's falling on her shoulders. And obviously, new reporting that's come out from the New York Times suggests that she was really sort of the puppet master when Facebook was trying to manage its response to the Russian interference. And she was sort of there responding to reports she was getting from her own staff saying, okay, let's just leave that private for now. Let's keep that between us for now. And it comes up again and again that she was sort of saying, let's not name Russia just yet. Let's not go public to the board with this just yet, despite calls from her own staff to sort of go public with this information they had.
Let's talk a little bit about the latest allegations against Sandberg specifically and Facebook. There were charges, the New York Times wrote about this, that they had hired a company to do essentially a smear campaign. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So they hired a company called Definers Public Affairs. And this is a company that is part public relations firm, part opposition research firm. And essentially, Definers went out there at Facebook's request and started researching Facebook's critics and its competitors. And among those critics was George Soros, who is a backer of a new organization called Freedom from Facebook that has been really critical of Facebook and has shown up at these hearings that Facebook executives have appeared at. And so Facebook was saying, huh, who is behind this group? And Definers finds that, hey, George Soros is, and starts seeding this information to reporters, including myself. And
So you were one of the reporters that got the pitch?
Of course, yeah.
What was the pitch?
Well, I can't say too much, but it was just, you know, you should be looking into these organizations, Freedom from Facebook, Open Markets Institute. They're positioning themselves as grassroots organizations, but in reality, they're backed by these billionaires. And I think, to defend them a little bit, I think in their mind, it was a straightforward campaign finance story, right? No different from if they said it's backed by the Koch brothers. But the challenge is we're at a time where George Soros has become this boogeyman of the alt-right, and especially it came at a time when George Soros had just received a mail bomb to his home. And I think it's interesting because when the news first broke, Mark Zuckerberg came out and said, you know, I didn't know anything about this. Sheryl didn't know anything about this. This was a company using dirty Washington tactics. This is not okay for Facebook. But really what's emerged since then is they were doing this at Facebook's request. The night before Thanksgiving, Facebook's head of comms, who was actually leaving the company, put out a blog post that said, yes, we did hire this firm. We did explicitly ask them to do these things. After this blog post published, Sheryl Sandberg added a little addendum. I want to reiterate, this was the night before Thanksgiving, saying, you know what, I didn't initially recognize the name Definers, but since I've looked into it, since my team has looked into it, I did receive some of the materials that they worked on. I was included on some emails regarding them. I think all reporters who cover Facebook thought it was pretty strange that the top two people at Facebook wouldn't have any idea about something we all knew about.
So there's also, Sheryl Sandberg has another layer to her experience, and that revolves around this other juggernaut that she's created, which is the Lean In, the book and her philosophy. I want to play a clip for you from Sheryl speaking at Davos in 2012.
We don't raise our daughters to be as ambitious as our sons. Little girls are called bossy. Anyone at Davos was a girl who was called bossy? If you got to Davos, you were that. I was.
But lately, because of Sheryl Sandberg's front and center at this at the issues surrounding Facebook, there have been a number of criticisms of her, not just as the COO of Facebook, but also this issue of, you know, really discrediting everything about Lean In. There was an article in The Nation last week that said, you know, Lean In has been discredited for good because of Sheryl Sandberg's recent, you know, activities. So are those two things linked? Should we be linking them?
I think that there are two ways to look at it. I think if you're being generous to Sheryl Sandberg, you would say she is a singular figure in business in America. She is, as I said, the number two person at the most powerful company in the world. And women don't have a lot of examples of that, and certainly women in tech don't have a lot of examples of that. And the fact that she's used that platform and that power to advocate for and to educate women about assuming those roles, I think, is important and can't be taken away from her. If you're not going to be generous to her, you would say that she is a shrewd, strategic business person who protects herself and her company at all costs and has done everything she can to burnish her reputation. And Lean In is one of those ways she's burnished her reputation. And we shouldn't allow that to paper over the fact or blind us to the fact that she has made some really poor decisions as COO of this tremendously powerful company.
Is there any indication that Sheryl Sandberg may be planning to leave Facebook? There have been rumors that she's been selling off stock. What's your sense there? And is there an internal support for Sandberg? Is there internal rebellion right now? What do we know?
What we know from some reporting is that there have been some employees speaking out against Sheryl Sandberg. But I also want to note it's not just Sheryl Sandberg. The morale at Facebook has fallen dramatically. The Wall Street Journal reported on an internal survey that showed just about half of employees are optimistic about the company's future. A year before, it was something like 80-some percent. So that's fallen dramatically. I haven't seen any indication that Sheryl Sandberg is leaving. Certainly, that's not what Mark Zuckerberg was messaging in his call with reporters. He said, I've worked with Sheryl Sandberg for a long time. She's been a great partner, and she will continue to be. He said, I hope I can work with her for decades. So that's obviously a strong show of faith from him.
I do also want to mention that we did here at The Takeaway reach out to both Sheryl Sandberg and Facebook for our reporting and have not yet received a response. Issy Lepowski is a senior writer for Wired. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for this podcast comes from Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. And you can too. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. Babbel users say they're amazed at how fast they learned and that they are confident in speaking their new language. Start learning a new language today. Just go to Babbel.com and use offer code TAKEAWAY to get 50% off your first 3 months. That's Babbel, BABBEL.com, offer code TAKEAWAY for 50% off your first 3 months.
Go to OmahaSteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut aged-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
Just days before President Trump's scheduled dinner with China's President Xi Jinping at the G20 meeting in Argentina, the president told the Wall Street Journal that he expects to increase tariffs on Apple products imported from China if the U.S. and China don't reach a deal. White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow doubled down on those threats yesterday.
The president will probably reiterate his view. We want a world, ideally, of zero tariffs, zero non-tariff barriers, and zero subsidies. To repeat, the president said there is a good possibility that we can make a deal, and he is open to it. And he has said, as recently as yesterday, the day before, if need be, if things don't work out in this U.S.-China summit meeting, he will invoke another $267-some-odd billion in tariffs.
Will these threats undermine a possible breakthrough on trade negotiations? Well, joining us now to discuss is Alex Lawson, senior reporter on international trade for Law 360 and the co-host of Law 360's Pro Se podcast. Alex, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So there's a big meeting coming up. We know it's the G20 a couple days away, but there's the relationship between President Trump and President Xi heading into this meeting, given the rhetoric of this week, is a little tense. What are we expecting?
Well, that's a great question, and it's not something that has a lot of clarity at this point. But what we know is that up until about a week ago, there was a lot of optimism that there could be something done, something in the vein of an announcement to generally agree not to do new tariffs on one another, and maybe we'll continue to talk about something a little grander down the line. That began to change last week when U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer put out a report that was basically like an addendum to the initial report they put out earlier this year that led to all these tariffs, which there's no mandate for him to do. The office just released it and said, hey, by the way, we still haven't seen any movement from China on these issues that we demanded changes on. And that was seen as kind of setting a pretense for something not happening at the G20. They're like, look, they haven't made these changes, so we're not going to ease up on them. And then that kind of carried forward in Trump's interview with the Wall Street Journal earlier this week. It's actually kind of curious to hear Larry Kudlow say that Trump thought there could be a deal, because in that Journal interview, he said, I don't see a deal happening this weekend. They got to get their messaging straight over there. So after a period of a little bit of optimism, despite what Kudlow says, I would say the prospects are pretty low for any kind of grand bargain this weekend.
Also, who has the upper hand here, really? I mean, the more we learn about what China's doing at the economic level and in the world as an economic power, are tariffs a threat to China at this point?
That's sort of the ace that Trump has up his sleeve, because we import more from China than they import from us. And it's a little ironic because that exact dynamic is what has Trump so angry, because he's always talking about the trade deficit. But in this context of applying tariffs, it actually kind of helps him. It helps him politically. He has more products to hit tariffs with than China does. So they can go for longer down this path. And the looming question has been whether they're willing to sort of go all the way to the hilt and basically put a punitive tariff on every single product that comes in from China. And you heard Kudlow in the sound there say they're ready to do that. The $267 billion bump that he's talking about would be the remainder of all trade that is not yet hit with tariffs. So
let's talk about that, though, because that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And who ultimately would that affect? I mean, that's going to affect our average everyday Americans, right? If we start putting tariffs on what China imports we've got in this country, who's going to pay for that?
Yeah, that's an important thing to consider. And they know that, too. And the way you can tell that is the way that they have staged these tariffs. The first tranche of tariffs covered about $50 billion. And that dealt mostly with sort of industrial inputs and things like that manufacturers use. So it was upstream stuff. It's like steel components and things like that. Things that don't affect the end user as much. But now this latest batch they put in, and certainly the next batch if they go that way, began to deal with like consumer electronics, furniture, appliances, things
iPods,
like that.
iPods, right? iPhones, yeah, all that, yeah.
Like most notably, like things that you and I and everyday Joe and Jane actually purchase with our money. And it takes a while for the effects of tariffs to actually work their way down. There are other mitigating factors that can blunt the effects of tariffs, but there's no question that if you start putting overly punitive tariffs on everyday items, the people who make and import those items are going to have to raise prices to, you know, sort of absorb that damage, and it's going to get passed on to the consumer.
And we just want to ask a follow-up question here. If you can speak to the situation with the United States and the World Trade Organization judges.
Yeah, that's the other thing that has to do with China a little bit, but that's the other sort of inflection point of trade friction you're going to be hearing about a lot. To keep it relatively brief, the World Trade Organization is where, you know, trade disputes are litigated among nations, right? And the ultimate body that has a say over that is called the appellate body. You can think of them as like the Supreme Court of trade. And judges, there are seven judges that sit on that body. And right now, the U.S. has decided to single-handedly stonewall the appointment of new judges. So there are seven seats. We're down to three right now. So there are only three of seven seats full. That's the minimum number it takes to hear even one case. When one more person leaves, which is scheduled to happen next December, so December 2019, they won't even be able to hear any cases. And the net effect of that is basically a weakening of like accountability in the legal trade system, right? The idea that you can't meaningfully sue anybody if they're doing something wrong, if there's no court to hear it. And part of the design of the World Trade Organization is that it operates by consensus. That means every single member has to agree on literally everything they do. Now, this seemed like a fine time when the US and the European Union and China and Canada, all the economic powerhouses, agreed on this system. But the Trump administration has a lot of problems. They claim that the appellate body is a threat to US sovereignty. They don't like the idea of foreign tribunals deciding what's appropriate about our trade policy, and they want to see real changes. They've made a couple of demands which get pretty weedy and wonky. The European Union has put forward a proposal to address those demands. So at this time when the Trump administration has been trying to repair its relations with the EU and Japan and the UK, we're going to launch trade talks with them. This thing, this issue over the World Trade Organization's appellate body and its judges is sort of the next point of friction that could emerge among the U.S. and its allies.
Fascinating. Alex Lawson is a senior reporter on international trade with Law 360 and the co-host of Law 360's Pro Se podcast. Alex, thanks again for your reporting.
Thank you so much.
Touchdown confirmed.
NASA scientists there celebrating big space news on Monday. NASA's InSight mission landed on Mars and began its exploration of the red planet's mysterious deep interior. But there's something a little more controversial brewing in the space community right now, and some astronomers don't feel like cheering about it. This weekend, an enormous satellite-shaped piece of art is set to launch into space. The inflatable work has no scientific purpose, just an aesthetic one. American artist Trevor Paglen created the 30-foot piece in partnership with the Nevada Museum of Art. It's called the Orbital Reflector, and it's meant to be visible from any spot on Earth. It will spend some 2 months in orbit before re-entering the Earth's atmosphere and disintegrating. Paglen told the media he wants the piece to get people thinking about the politics of space and who has a right to that space by drawing people's gaze upwards. But what do scientists say? Jackie Faraday is an astrophysicist at the American Museum of Natural History. Jackie, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So I must admit, I heard about this story and said, I don't understand why, what we're talking about, shooting stuff into space and why this is so, what, an issue. Why is it an issue?
Issue. So let's just even discuss what it is that's going on. So
please.
An art project that is self-described as a functionless satellite being launched into space, in part to inspire, to get people to look up. Now, they're right there. We've got something we should talk about, since this is a fake object that is supposed to get you excited about looking up and considering the nighttime sky. Already, I think we're missing something. The nighttime sky is filled with natural things that we could look up at, filled with stars, filled with planets. Just look at the moon. That's easy. And we do need to take into consideration how we're going to treat space. But this is not the way to do it.
So an artist would probably say to a scientist, well, that's your scientific point of view, but this is about art. This isn't about science.
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot. And so I'm a huge fan of the science-art collaboration. I actually think some of the best things that we can come up with as humans could come from true collaborations between a scientist and an artist. One of my favorite lines from a movie is the movie Contact. The female character gets sent into space, and they could only send one person, and they chose to send a scientist. And her line, which sticks with me, almost haunts me all the time when I'm doing my own work, is, they should have sent a poet.
They should have sent a poet.
So beautiful.
And that summarizes to me a lot of the beauty of what goes on between science and art. But you need to inform each other. And so this particular project, I think, is lacking in the understanding of what are you trying to do. So just from the sheer aspect of launching something into space that we have to deal with now. So as an astronomer, I go to the telescope a lot. I'm going to Chile tomorrow for an observing run. I go into these remote places of the world to use a giant light bucket to stare at things that are hundreds of light years away from us. But I have to stare at things that are above the Earth. And so from just from this standpoint, satellites are a problem for us. They are just straight up vermin. This object will streak across images. And when it does, I have to throw those images away. And it's very expensive time that you have on telescopes. This is part of why astronomers are not happy. And I get that artists want to take a look at the sky with their own perspective, but it needs to be informed about everything that we have and everything that we do in astronomy.
How big of an issue is this really? I mean, this is one art project that the artist is saying will disintegrate. Is there an issue of people shooting things into the sky? And you mentioned satellites, but is there a bigger issue of sort of space junk?
So this is, we're in a special time for humans and space exploration. And the privatization of space exploration is full on forward right now. So the question of, is it a problem? We're not quite at a problem area yet, but it could quickly become a problem.
You said something now that really caught my attention, the privatization of space exploration. I'm less concerned, I think, about the tension between art and astrophysicists and more about this issue of who gets to do this.
Yes.
Across at all, right?
This is a major topic right now where it's almost like the Wild Wild West at this point, because you have people with money, Elon Musk, excellent example, that's making it cheap enough that raise yourself some funds and you can launch something into space. What else can we launch into space that we are all forced to look at it? The nighttime sky is shared across everywhere for all humans. What if you wanted to launch a sign about an advertisement? Is that on the docket?
Is it?
I worry about it all the time. I was recently at a space summit that was here in New York City that was talking about these exact topics with top leaders in the space science industry. And because it's the Wild Wild West in the sense that we're not doing it yet and people are still developing the technology which will make it possible, we need to establish the ground rules now.
Who's in charge of space?
Oh, man. So this, again, it's another interesting topic. No one owns space. And countries have to come together and make decisions in a unified way about what we will all decide is right and not right to do. Because if you have a launch pad, you can go. There's definitely a twofold problem. The first fold problem of the policy of what's going to happen. Like, you could send a slave ship up there right now if you wanted. There's no rule. As soon as you get off the planet, so there's people that are working on a constitution of space behavior. So another good example is there's junk up there left and right already. Countries launch things. We don't ask each other. It's not like, oh, hey, what are you doing? Can I launch something now? And how many things do you have at 300 miles above the Earth? But don't put too much stuff there, because then we're all trapped here because we can't fly through debris to get off. As soon as you do
this. You mean on Earth?
Yeah, yeah. We're stuck on Earth.
Oh, my God.
Because somebody's got to clean it up. You can't clean up everything that's up there.
You mean there'll be so much junk in the sky that if we need to escape, we won't be able to?
Yeah. It'll be too dangerous. I mean, that's like fast forward.
I'm having visions of like Star Wars, the original.
Yeah.
As they're sort of flying through all those meteors.
You're not actually going into an asteroid field.
They'd be crazy to follow us, wouldn't they?
That kind of what it would be like?
I mean, the danger is more, it's more a threat level. I don't think we'd ever get to that point because then you wouldn't be able to see anything. And also the Star Wars scenes where they're navigating through, those have always been scientifically incorrect. Like the asteroid belt, for instance, is not as, this is just one of these things astronomers love to point out.
I'm feeling so terrible now. I'm like, they're scientifically incorrect.
Don't be sad. It's okay. They also, they call it a parsec. You know the big joke in Star Wars about the parsec?
You've never heard of the Millennium Falcon? Should I have?
It's a ship that made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs.
They just keep bringing it back up because they know, like, oh, it's, you know, it's a distance measurement. It's not a time thing. And the Star Wars people just think it's funny to keep throwing it in our face.
So if I talk about, like, pigs in space from The Muppet Show, that's not, that's even worse.
And now, pigs in space!
Yeah, but that's cute, so that's different.
That is space art. That's what that is.
This isn't, the orbital reflector is not space art. I mean, it is and it isn't.
Jackie Faraday is an astrophysicist at the American Museum of Natural History. Jackie, thanks so much for your comments.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Thank you. And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.